There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. My guest today is Abdullah Abujadeh, or I'm going to have him correct that if he needs to. He is the MARVEL Microreactor Program Lead at the Idaho National Laboratory, and we'll talk about what MARVEL is. So it is an acronym, but we'll talk about what that is. Welcome, Abdullah.
Thanks for having me, Rod. And yes, you got my name spot on, so kudos to you for it's not an easy one to get right.
Yep. So, Abdullah, how long have you been with the MARVEL program?
So I'm coming on in 2 years now as the head of the project. I've been working tangentially with the MARVEL program for a while before that point. But at the helm, I've been in this position for 2 years now.
Tell us a little bit about MARVEL. As I understand it, it is not only a microreactor, it's a really small microreactor.
Yes, it's definitely on the smaller side of the spectrum. So it's about 85 kilowatt thermal is what we're designing it for. It's using NaC, so sodium potassium, as its coolant. The primary loop is naturally convecting. And the fuel type is a trigger fuel elements that you see in university reactor. So it's uranium zirconium hydride at HALEU level enrichment. We like to joke at INL that we like to find every hook and cranny to shove a reactor in. Ours was the treat spent fuel storage pit, basically. So we're going to go into the treat pit to store the reactor, and that's what limited us in terms of size and power output, essentially.
Okay, now, as I understood it, the MARVEL reactor initially started off with Stirling engines as a way to convert heat into electricity. What is the current plan?
We're still going to be using Stirling engines, but what we found out with our engineering demonstration unit we call PCAT is it's very hard to directly integrate these Stirling engines on the reactor for multiple reasons. One is the vibration challenges you have to account for right above the reactor. Second is the interfacing coolant between the Stirling engine and the reactor. We went through multiple iterations of lead bismuth, galistan, so a very corrosive metal, and we've been struggling to work with these elements. So ultimately what we decided to do when we had to pivot last year and go for a more traditional approach where we have a secondary NaC loop now, a secondary forced convecting sodium potassium loop that then takes heat out to a tertiary loop, which is a high-tech salt, so a solar salt loop, that then is coupled to Stirling engines for power generation or as process heat delivery directly for end users that want to be using MARVEL for other applications too to get high-grade salt temperatures.
So as I understand the Stirling cycle, you have to have one side that gets heated as hot as you can, and the other side has to be cooled to keep the piston going up and down. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. And we do that with a glycol loop. So there's a glycol loop that stays about 60 to 80 degrees Celsius that keeps it cold and goes to dumps the heat to the air radiator. And then the hot side is going to be interfacing with salt right now is what we're going to be doing.
So have you had any trouble fitting the rest of the system in? I know the reactor can fit into that kind of small pit that was there for treat. What about that building is not huge. Where's the rest of the power system going to go?
Right, exactly. So that's one of the reasons why we had a big analysis of alternative, as we call it, in the space where we evaluated different options. And that's one of the reasons why we went for a sodium potassium secondary system. These can be pretty compact. It's a pretty effective a coolant. So it's going to be essentially a box, a container sized box that we put next to the reactor. So we just have piping going from the reactor now to the side of the treat building. So the NAC portion will stay within the treat building itself. And then the salt, because it's not radioactive and it's not flammable, we can pump it directly outside of the building. And then now we have kind of an energy park, if you will, outside of the treat building where we can connect different things. The Stirling engines will be outside as well. So we can play around with different experiments on the outside of the facility and not have to be space constrained inside of the treat walls.
Have you been doing any experimentation with your solar salt, hot temperatures, and making sure that the corrosion problems that are associated with salt are not a problem?
Right. So the we've done a few tests with putting heaters and salt baths into the Stirling engines to evaluate how they behave, and the free thawing interaction. Actually, that's another problem we ran into with our engineering demonstration unit, is if you have Stirling engines vibrating on lead bismuth, You get a lot of, especially when things start to cool off and thaw down and you're still vibrating, you can break the coils and break the engines. We had a lot of engine failures that way, unfortunately. And actually, we saw it was a lot more a positive outlook when we had these tests done. So we're pretty happy with that decision to go for salt, interfacing with the Stirling engines. In terms of corrosion rates, it's a very well understood high-tech salt. So it's what you typically use in the solar industries and a lot of industrial processes. So the it's not like some of these exotic salts that you see in molten salt reactors, say, or things of that nature, where the corrosion is a bit less understood and you're not getting funky fission products or impurities getting into that salt. And because of the lifetime of Marvel being pretty limited, it's a non-capitalized asset, so it has a pretty limited timeline right now, officially of 2 years. We're not expecting to run into, at high temperatures that we're operating in, significant corrosion challenges, for what it's worth.
Once Marvel starts running, what is the application that you expect to use it for?
So one of the key goals for Marvel, so our main goal is to serve kind of as a pathfinder, and we can talk about that separately. But a secondary goal is to serve as a test bed. So we want Marvel to be kind of a platform where we could do R&D and cool science with, basically. We've already identified 5 end users that we want to work with. So we've announced that last fall. So it's Amazon Web Services, DCX, 2 data center companies that want to look into how the dynamics of islanded nuclear reactors coupled to computing powers in a microgrid environment. The third company is GE Vernova, that's interested in remote operations of nuclear reactors and remote controls and having secondary control rooms as a way to mitigate safety risks and also reduce costs potentially. The fourth company is RDT, they're a detector company, and detectors are a big bottleneck in supply chain right now. So they're developing novel micropocket fission detectors that they want to be testing at Marvel to build confidence to use these in commercial reactors in the future. And then the fifth company is a consortium between Natura Energy, ConocoPhillips, and NOV. They're interested in desalination for oil and gas. So interestingly enough, in the fracking industry, for every barrel of oil that you generate, they quote me about something like 5 barrels of salty water that's saltier than the sea that they have to deal with and dispose of, and they're interested in using nuclear energy to help with remediation and disposing of this salt. So you can see how Marvel is being used for a lot of applications. And within the DOE programs, outside of these commercial companies, we're working with the safeguarding programs at NNSA on how you safeguard microreactor using Marvel, with the Prometheus program on AI applications with Marvel, the NEEMS program on modeling and simulation and benchmarking their codes against Marvel, plenty of other R&D activities that we're hoping to do with Marvel itself.
When Marvel first started, I heard a lot of talk and announcements about the fact that they expected it to be the first microreactor and maybe the 53rd
right.
reactor operating here at INL. Obviously, the speed of the reactor pilot program had something to do with changing that path. But also, Marvel ran into some delays. You mentioned one about the Stirling engine relocation. What other kinds of delays have caused the Marvel program to be more of a pathfinder than a first of a kind?
So one thing I will say is that a lot of the reason the pilot program was able to go very fast is because of projects like Marvel and Pele, and I should also give credits to Pele. So when the DOE standard 1271 was being drafted, it incorporated a lot of lessons learned from Marvel's experience. So we submitted a PDSA that we had to retract because of the Stirling engine challenges we faced in 2024. And one of the takeaways there was, well, we don't need to wait till line exam design completion to submit a PDSA, which was the original DOE requirement. The new standard encourages earlier engagement with the regulator to start getting feedback back from the regulator to then incorporate into a final design for the DSA. So a lot of the reasons why you can see these pilot program projects going faster is because of projects like Marvel. Another thing I'd like to point out is that the lab as a whole had atrophied that muscle about reactor design and reactor safety analysis. Programs like Marvel help rebuild that capacity. So because of projects like Marvel, we've retrained our staff and our workforce into how you do these kinds of safety analyses, reviewing of documentation, designing, understanding where the pitfalls are, that we've been able to then share. To my chagrin, actually, like a lot of my people from the Marvel program have ended up working on these other projects or getting their time split or in some cases being poached by these companies as well, which is a good and bad thing, obviously. So that's one of the reasons why I think Marvel has been key to helping the pilot program in and of itself. Now, in terms of why we weren't able to go faster in the Marvel side of things, it's a range of issues, range of challenges that I think a lot of companies have faced as well. Part of it is design, right? Like we've sometimes pigeonholed ourselves in design options that were suboptimal for manufacturing, that are challenging to build. We've had a lot of fabrication challenges right now that we're working through with a fabricator. But in our case, we're at least being open about and transparent about them. So at the ANS conference, we had a lessons learned panel where we shared some of these findings. So hopefully a lot of our challenges will benefit some of these other companies that are going to be encountering some of the similar problems. We talked about the Stirling engines as well as one of the challenges that we had to face with, and that's definitely slowed us down. We've encountered some fuel fabrication challenges too that we're working through right now. In a lot of these cases, it's things that Marvel was kind of started up with the philosophy that we wanted it to be as close as possible to off-the-shelf components. But what we realized is small variations in specs, you know, that you wouldn't think would be a problem turning out to be a bigger problem than they are, and we're finding that the hard way. And we're being very transparent about all of these hurdles that we've encountered. We're going to be publishing another lessons learned report. We had one from last year that we published, and we're going to be doing another even more detailed one this year about all these challenges that we face. Because the hope is that I think, you know, you get a lot of positive spin in the nuclear industry about all these things that happen. You get the impression that everything went very easily, but reality is more often than not far from that case. So we're trying to be very open about these challenges that we face so that hopefully other people can benefit from it and leverage it too in the future.
Do you think the decision to build a very small unit that really doesn't seem like it would ever be a commercial design had any problem with your supply chain? Because having been a supplier one time in the past, I'd have a hard time working with somebody who was trying to build a one-of-a-kind to begin with. Because no incentive for me to make many investments.
Yeah, well, the starting point, I would say, the first thing I want to mention is that Marvel was intentionally not designed to be commercially competitive, right? We're a DOE program. By mandate, we're not supposed to compete with the private sector companies. We're not hoping to make money off of Marvel. It's really a test reactor for us to learn from and to test novel things you could do with nuclear energy with. So that was by design. That said, we tried to keep close to previous designs. So Marvel is widely recognized to be based off of the space reactor program from the SNAP series of reactors. So there's a lot of parallels there. So we try to keep close to existing designs. There are some first-of-a-kind aspects to Marvel, like the idea of integrating with the Stirling engine directly on the reactor. That was very novel, actually, in and of itself. And that was turned out to be a big risk for the program, ultimately. On the supply chain side of things, the biggest one we've kind of are struggling with is getting nuclear grade suppliers that can do ASME Section 3 to 5 material for vessels. Actually, I believe the Venn diagram for NSTAP material suppliers and ASME Section 3 to 5 qualified materials is almost zero. So what we had to do, actually, I'm pretty proud that Marvel was one of the first program, and I think in U.S. history, to use a non-NSTAM vendor to build our guard vessel and our primary vessel for the reactor. We used commercial grade dedication there, and we've commercially grade dedicated a lot of things in nuclear industry before, but never a vessel itself, not a very primary vessel. So we did that by embedding our QA team directly with their team. Unfortunately, our QA guy has to fly over there almost every week to witness all the different operations and all different steps in the processes. And that's how we believe we've helped expand the supply basis for nuclear using commercial accreditation in unique ways to expand the basis. But that's not to say it's nothing come without problems. Mm-hmm. We've realized that some kinds of welds for SNE materials are more problematic than others. We realize that heat treatments should follow certain paths versus others. The code sometimes can pigeonhole you into rabbit holes that are not ideal from a manufacturing standpoint. We've encountered a lot of challenges with all of these steps along the way. I'm happy to talk more about them if you're interested, Ron. But those are things that are stumbling blocks that we've encountered as part of that process.
So would you consider that the Marvel program is doing a very large percentage of what it was initially thought to do, or how would you judge that?
I think so. I think it's still living to the original intent of the program. Like the original vision of Marvel was to kind of help break through batteries. We've lost a lot of know-how, atrophied a lot of muscle memory, if you will, in the industry and in the national lab when it comes to building designing reactor. So the original point of Marvel was to kind of help unblock things and go through it with a taxpayer-funded project that could be widely available and shared with different stakeholders, rather than a first-mover disadvantage kind of stuck scenario where private companies don't want to be the first ones to do these things because they're worried about how to do the first of a kind of these things. So Marvel helped kind of trailblaze, remove a lot of these risks for these companies, and you're seeing a lot of them now proceed even faster than Marvel, hopefully thanks to us in some cases. Some companies are even going as far as leveraging parts of our designs. So we're in contact with companies about, you know, our control drums being used for other companies' design aspects. And a lot of the people in Marvel have now gone into these companies, some of them even spun off their own companies as well, using the know-how that they've gained designing, building, and testing Marvel and applying it to industrial commercial cases that have helped them proceed a lot faster than they would have otherwise if Marvel never existed, basically.
You mentioned that you're working with folks that want to do remote control of the microreactors. Tell me a little bit about the control system at Marvel that allows it, at least, you know, kind of builds the case that you can do this remotely.
Absolutely. So I think you're hitting the nail on the head here. Marvel is foundation is perfect for these kinds of applications because of its safety basis. So while we're pushing the boundaries here a lot on the safety basis side of reactor design, so we are not crediting any operator action for the safety case of a reactor, nor are we crediting our control system as a safety grade system, basically. We are, of course, crediting the manual scram button and the seismic scramming features of the reactors and other features as well. But the operators, the interface, having to play around with control drum, things of that nature, we rely entirely on design passive features and inherent features like the prompt reactivity feedback from the trigger fuel elements to keep the reactor in safe configuration. So that makes us perfect as a use case to then test novel control paradigms with. Because the INC system is not safety grade, it's easier for us, at least to make the case, of doing novel remote operations with, or potentially AI controlled system, autonomous controls systems with. And it's perfect to do it with Marvel, because if we do it with Marvel, it's an open platform again, where we can publish information and know-how broadly to help all industry companies as well, rather than if you did it with, you know, with single companies, or, you know, only they would benefit and nobody else would have that information that would be siloed otherwise.
So that's one advantage of having government-funded programs, is that the information that's developed in that government-funded program is more widely shared. Is that part of why you think that Marvel's got its a real case for being there?
Absolutely, and all the more case because we got our letter from the department it's called our intent to share letter from the Department of Nuclear Energy, and that allows us to actually even remove the export control classification from our paperwork, our documentation, our drawings. And I'm hoping we're going through that process right now. Actually, I was in a meeting just before you came along, talking with some of the classification reviewers that are looking at our documentation. We're hoping to get as much of that all in the public sphere as we can. It's going to be critical for AI training as well. With all these AI companies and AI tools want to have access to detailed design information on nuclear reactors that are non-export controlled. So I think Marvel information will be critical for some of these things as well. And even beyond that, our data will be very valuable for the stakeholder community as well. So we established a collaboration with the NE4 program called DUNCASH. So it's a criticality safety program under the HALEU program. And we're going to turn Marvel into international criticality benchmark problem. So again, like these companies, they get criticality measurements, but then they don't share it more broadly. And there's a lot of gaps in the nuclear data on HALEU fuel system designs that Marvel is hopefully going to be able to plug. So by being an open reactor funded by a taxpayer, that data will be published. It'll be in conference papers and journal articles and in a benchmark submission to the international body, basically, as well.
Okay, so now the program has been around since, what, about 2021 or something?
2020 is what?
2020?
Yeah.
Okay, and at this point, where are you in the reviews? When are you going to go critical, for example?
Our target date for criticality is December of this calendar year, so that's what we're shooting for right now. We have submitted our PDSA, so that's our initial safety documentation for DOE authorization, in September of last year.
And to interrupt you just for a second. So PDSA is preliminary documented safety analysis. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah. Okay. And this is kind of the first step in your submission for DOE authorization. This is a parallel path to the NRC to get authorizing for turning on a reactor. So that first hurdle was submitted in September, and we got it approved around February time. Of course, the department were very grateful for them for working with all these pilot program reactors. They were prioritizing as part of the executive order, so they were trying to squeeze us in with their busy schedule. We then submitted our DSA shortly thereafter for dry criticality, I should clarify, in May. And we're hoping to get that approved within the next month or so. We're currently addressing the comments from the department that we've received back from them. Once we get that set up, we have our vessel in-house and the fuel and everything ready, we're hoping to start our readiness reviews for dry criticality again in November and fall, basically, time frame is what we're expecting to happen, to then turn on and go critical in December, run our criticality experiments then. And then in 2027, we'll be installing our balance of plant, so that secondary NACS kit I was describing, the tertiary salt loop, all these things during that time frame in 2027, testing it all out, and then getting to full power operation in 2028. Of course, we'll have to go through another round of reviews with the department to get approval from them for full power operations, but we're targeting around 2028 time frame for full power testing.
Okay, so explain to me, or explain to the audience, why do you go to dry criticality? What's the advantage of going to a critical operation without your coolant in the loop?
So there's multiple reasons to do so. The first one is, just like we had an engineering demonstration unit to test the thermal hydraulics of the system with a fully flowing NAC loop to validate our codes, in this case it's RELAP, what we use for thermal hydraulics, it behooves you to do the same thing for your neutronics. So before going to full power operation, it's important to understand the neutronics and the reactor physics behavior of the reactor. So having an initial starting point of testing these things in a criticality configuration is critical. And that's what typically you've seen historically with all these programs you do with a dry zero power or cold critical experiment first to get the data that you need to make the case for full power operation. Another key goal of that is to also help de-risk our technology earlier. So we're going to be testing our integrated system, so our control drums, with our INC, with our operators, the fuel loading, all these aspects that you want to bite off a lot of that risks earlier rather than later. So in our original timeline, we would have done it all at once in 2028. So we would have had to build the whole thing together, go critical, and find out any issues then and there, which would have been a bit more challenging to then rectify. And that's actually one of the other reasons why our dry criticality is set up the way it is. It has a lot of the similar features that you'd have in the real reactor. So we're using the same vessel, the same fuel, the same reflector, the same control drums. So very little changes compared to some of these other criticalities that you might have seen in industry. So it's going to be very representative of what you see for full power, with the difference that it's what we're calling kind of a naked configuration, where we don't have our guard vessel inserted. So we can actually access the control drums, access the core more easily. If there are problems that we encountered, we'll have a chance to address them now, whereas in the full power configuration, it would have been a lot harder to then go in and, it's a welded piece at that point. It would have been a lot more challenging to make any fixes at that point. And then the last thing to point out is that we would get data to the industry faster. So that benchmarking data I mentioned is critical for buying down margins that some of these companies have for transportation of HALEU fuel and turning on reactors as well, and how over-designed their control systems are. I'm hoping by making that data available in the industry right now to plug in some of these gaps we have in nuclear data, the sooner we can do so, the more beneficial it will be for the industry as a whole.
Now, as part of the advantage of the dry criticality and doing the testing that way, over going in and having your coolant, which in your case is NAC, sodium, potassium, that once you put sodium, potassium in the system, now moving things around, taking your fuel rods out, taking out your control drums, becomes more difficult.
Absolutely.
Because they now have been wetted with this sodium, potassium. And I mean, I saw a facility here, well, it's now a different facility, but at one time they used to use it to wash or clean sodium off of reactor components. Are you going to need to have something like that for your fuel if you do a refueling?
So actually, that's exactly the Correct. So in our case, sodium loading is an irreversible step, really. Like we it would be very challenging for us to remove all of that sodium from the core. So that's, and actually we wouldn't be even be able to do incremental fuel loading in that core. So right now in the direct criticality core, we're envisaging incremental assembly loading and doing one over N measurements, which we couldn't have done in the same way with a wetted core, essentially. So yes, absolutely. This is one reason, again, why we went for direct criticality. In of itself, it would help avoid some of these hurdles. And you mentioned refueling. Actually, Marvel is designed not to be refueled right now. So the fuel could exceed the 2-year operation that we're currently planning for. And there's potential for Marvel's lifetime to be extended beyond the 2 years of operation. But the fuel can last much beyond that point. The burn up is pretty minimal on the reactor. It's not intended to test the boundaries of trigger fuel burn up necessarily. So that's why we opted for a once fueled core. In the future, this could be revisited, but right now it's not part of our design envelope and requirements.
Okay, so that's not one of the things that you guys are going to show to other people, how you refuel the reactor and what do you do with the fuel you take out, that kind of stuff.
Well, one thing we will show is how you decommission these kinds of reactors. So micro-reactor decommissioning is also part of our life cycle R&D application. So Marvel is useful before it goes critical with all the data we generate, drawings, all these things. Once it goes critical with the data we generate, the tests we can do, once it gets to full power operation with what it can power as well. And then when they decommission it as well, I think there'll be some lessons learned there. We're open to testing, you know, novel decommissioning techniques and novel fuel handling techniques to see what that could lead to. A novel recovery process for the uranium as well. We're in touch with the material recovery program as well on what we can do on that front as well. So I'm hoping there'll be some PIE, so post-irradiation examination, that we could do to help inform the industry on what's the art of the possible for decommissioning and fuel handling at the end of a life cycle for micro reactor as well.
Okay. Is some sort of operator training program part of what you have to submit for your documented safety analysis? Is that part of it? And if it is, how have you gone about building the training program for whoever's going to operate this? And I know you said the operators aren't really very important in terms of your safety case, but you're going to want to make sure you operate it to keep it intact.
Absolutely, yeah. And even though, you know, they're not their intervention is not necessarily going to determine the safety base of the reactor. Of course, they're very important for the manual scram and intervening within our required timeline for scramming the reactor, things of that nature. But yeah, so we've been pretty diligent about implementing a full training program. So we've had we've submitted a tech spec for our operators as part of our submission for the documented safety analysis to DOE. They've been training on fuel handling right now, so we've made them 3D mock-ups, plastic base of the core and of the fuel, so they could practice with fuel loading and how they're going to handle the material. Just a few weeks ago, we had a kind of a get-together, if you will, of the INC team with the operators, with our control drum, the actual finished hardware for our control drums and the actual finished hardware for our cabinets as well, where they've interfaced and played around with them. We've had a simulated response rates for our kinetics parameters for the reactor, where they could take it critical basically, or see what happens if they overshot criticality, how it would peak power and then drop back down. It's a perfectly safe configuration. And when we have visitors, actually, we let them have a go at overshooting and showing them how safe it is and how it kind of shuts itself back down.
Isn't that one of the things that Trig has always been?
Correct.
Their advantage is that overshoot and bring it back down.
Yeah, so I mean, most reactors we design in America all have a negative feedback coefficient, as you probably know, Rod. So the advantage, though, in a trigger system is it's very negative. Like, it's such a strongly prompt negative coefficient that it's very hard for you to, like, get the fuel heated past its limits before it shuts itself back down, basically. And that's what we could prove with these demos, is you're using the real hardware, the real software, the real operators, all playing around with the HMI that we've currently designed. And then showing them how that happens and having them learn and practice on it, on the system before they go to the real system itself.
So how big is your staff on the Marvel program?
It's tough to pinpoint exactly. We have a lot of suppliers across the country, really, that we're leaning to, we're leveraging. So our budget, our annual commercial allocation, is about $30 million per year. We estimate with an INL, even our INL staff are not full-time on Marvel. Again, as I mentioned, they a lot of them help other reactor projects as well, which is great for them. Sometimes not as great for me. But but usually on our all hands meeting for internally at Marvel, we typically have around like 40 staff members that are present at one time, and it fluctuates, right? Like, you know, during design period, there was a lot more INL staff involvement, so we were a much broader Marvel team. But now that we're kind of shifting towards fabrication more, it's a lot more on the supplier side of things that are building and machining all the parts and pieces or procuring them for us to leverage. And design team is a bit shrunk. It's more about checking things when the ASBL data comes in and that sort of thing at that point.
So obviously the Marvel reactor is never going to be anything commercial. Is there any plan to go through an NRC licensing process for that pathway building, or you say with DOE authorization?
So it's funny you mentioned, we've been talking with the DOE program on regulatory modernization. This is a DOE-funded program that works a lot with NRC on what can be learned from the DOE space to the NRC space. And one thing we've been discussing is a crosswalk from using Marvel as a template for a crosswalk from DOE authorization to NRC licensing, potentially using AI tools as well. So that's one thing we want to do in the future. For the direct criticality configuration, it's probably not as useful. But once we have our full power PDSA documentation completed and submitted to the department, that could be a great use case that's going to be open for everybody to potentially benefit from, on how you do a crosswalk between the DOE all the way to NRC licensing basis. So I think that this is one example of how you can use Marvel information to help inform the commercial side on how you can do these things in the future. And then, you know, I mentioned how we have all these commercial end users with Marvel, these where we are, you know, like, though we are a commercial company, some commercial companies are hoping to benefit from what they learn from Marvel for their designs as well.
What is the reason that you chose NAC as opposed to sodium itself?
So that actually predates me, but I'll do my best at kind of bringing back the team's thinking at the time. The biggest advantage for NAC is that it's you don't have to heat trace it, and it stays liquid in a room temperature environment. So that was part of the key advantage with NAC. It's more reactive when it comes in contact with air or water than sodium does. So that's one of the trade-offs, is you have to be more careful about how you handle confinement boundaries and any fire hazards. The trainings our people have to go through will be different than what you typically do for any other types of fire. You can't use water, for instance, things of that nature. But it was pretty advantageous compared to sodium, in the fact that you didn't have to worry about heat tracing it, and starting it up will be a lot more straightforward because you don't have to melt it first before you start it up. Things of that nature helps a lot.
Does it change the maximum temperature you can operate at?
So we have a lot of temperature limits. So NAC boiling point is one of the limits we have. But I think it is one of our limits. But there's several others that we have to worry about, from fuel clad temperatures, the creep fatigue limits on our vessels as well. All of these have kind of pushed us towards a primary coolant operating temperature of 530 degrees Celsius. Now, in theory, you could design a system for higher temperatures of operation, but typically for sodium reactors, you're operating within that time frame, generally speaking. The temperature range.
Yeah. All right. Well, Abdullah, I appreciate all the conversation. I want to give you the opportunity. Is there something I should have asked you that I didn't?
I think what I like to just usually start with regarding Marvel is highlight that it has three key missions, is how I like to frame it. One is to serve as a pathfinder. So I mentioned how we are learning things and disseminating them as broadly as possible through lessons learned report and conference papers and panels and things of that nature to help the industry more broadly. The second one is to serve as a testbed. And I've kind of spoken to about our end users, things of that nature. But a third one that we only briefly touched on is to serve as an R&D use case. So Marvel is also, because we have a lot of data, a plethora of data available, whenever you talk to all these other researchers at the lab, they tend to work with paper designs that are not necessarily realistic to study reactor concepts. And I think Marvel will be key in terms of helping them get very robust, real designs. So, you know, do MCMP models and the thermohydraulic models, where they're very important and foundational to reactor designs. It's only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to what you need to submit to the documentation for designing a full-fledged reactor. So Marvel is helping kind of fill that gap throughout the whole spectrum, and helping our researchers community within INL, the other national labs, and also academia more broadly, understand what it takes to make a real reactor. How did you go from an MCMP model to a detailed drawing? Then when you go to fabricating it, what are as-built redlining looks like? So I think going through that whole life cycle in an open fashion is very critical to helping support the training, the workforce development, the know-how, the R&D we could use for the United States as a whole. So I'm hoping Marvel can serve that the nation more broadly in that phase as well.
Okay. So it sounds like you're going to be pretty busy for the next couple of years, and then you'll be able to operate for a couple of years after that. So, you know, start decommissioning Marvel probably, what, around 2032, something like that?
Well, I hope not. So right now, officially, I have to be careful here. We are planned, because we're a non-capitalized asset, to run for 2 years and continue to 2030. But of course, DOE and Congress have it within their power to extend our lifetime. So we have a lot of conservatism built into Marvel, so we could run Marvel for a longer period of time. Not drastically. It's not going to be a reactor that runs for 30 years or anywhere close to ATR's lifetime, for instance. But we could definitely go beyond the two-year window, is my expectation. So I hope we push that decommissioning date further back. But as I said, even when we get to decommissioning, I think it's still going to be very useful for our stakeholders, as I mentioned before, to learn how you decommissioning things. So we should get there sooner rather than later to help pave the way as well on those sides of things as well.
All right. Thanks, Abdullah.
All right. Thank you.
And I'm gonna sign off by trying to say your name to show that I remembered from the beginning to end. Abdullah Abuade.
Abujaure, yeah, thank you.
Abujaure, okay. All right, thanks.
Thank you very much.
This is Rod Adams, host of The Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. I've been providing insights into atomic energy and advocating for better nuclear industry performance and accelerated growth since 1995. I hope you've had the chance to enjoy and learn from many of these posts and podcasts. But that's not all I'm doing. 6 years ago, I entered into a partnership that lets me invest into some of the most exciting young companies in the energy industry. With my partner, Valerie Gardner, we launched Nucleation Capital Fund 1, a non-traditional venture fund, to focus on investing into ventures that we believe are well-positioned to flourish. Those companies will help us all reduce dangerous dependence on fossil fuels by using ever-increasing amounts of abundant, affordable, dependable, and clean nuclear energy. If you are an accredited investor, you can join us. What makes us non-traditional is that we allow regular people to invest in innovative private ventures in amounts from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We reduce costs and risk by building diversified portfolios using an online venture fund custodian. That custodian can help you determine if you qualify under SEC rules as an accredited investor and helps make our fund accessible and affordable. Investors subscribe at the level they can afford for the number of quarters they prefer. We've made 25 investments, and we continue to see many exciting investment opportunities. If you believe in the long-term prospects of nuclear energy and want to put a portion of your patient investment dollars to work, please reach out, as every quarter we make 1 to 3 investments, but you have to be subscribed to get an allocation. Please visit our website, nucleationcapital.com, where you'll find a wealth of information. That's nucleationcapital, all one word, .com. If the content you find stimulates you to take the next step towards investing, please fill out an investor interest form. There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.